Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today's the 3rd of March. We'll listen to Master Tenjin Chosen's previous program, Anger and Patience, and please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and welcome once more to Radio Dharma. Recently I had a phone call from a friend in Australia, and we got talking about David Hicks, the man who spent the last 5 years in Guantanamo Bay. My friend told me that many people in Australia he's talked to are angry that Hicks is to be allowed back into the country. They say he's a terrorist, and some even say that if they see him in the street, they may take a potshot at him. It struck me that this kind of attitude really reflects what we've been talking about in the programs over the last few weeks. David Hicks has spent the last 5 years in what is allegedly pretty horrible conditions. We can have no idea how that has changed his thinking or attitudes, whether he still thinks the same way as he did when he trained with the Taliban. In fact, we have no real idea about him at all. Yet we can make judgments and allow our minds to become overcome by anger merely by the mention of the man's name. Isn't this illogical? You might argue that he admitted complicity with a terrorist organization. But that was in a plea deal, which essentially tells us nothing about what he's really guilty of or how far he went. Of course he would make a plea deal if it meant getting out of a place like Guantanamo Bay, wouldn't you? But now look at the effect of developing anger at him, even to the point of wanting to take a pot shot at him. Isn't that mind exactly the same mind that bombers are using in Iraq? The mind that says, I don't like you or what you stand for, so I'm going to try and kill you. Isn't that in itself a terrorist kind of mind? Can we really believe that such a mind will not be as harmful to ourselves as it would be to David Hicks? In developing this kind of angry attitude, it's not Hicks that is the terrorist. It is the vicious mind of anger that takes us over and makes us behave in ways worse than a terrorist. I think it would be much better to reserve our judgment, develop some compassion for the time Hicks spent with the Americans, and keep our mind calm and unruffled by his return to Australia. Not only does that give David Hicks some slack to settle his accounts and move on, but it keeps us safe from the effects, now and in the future, of placing angry imprints on our minds. Those imprints will cause us much, much more agony than any David Hicks or Osama bin Laden could dream up for us. So with a thought to be of benefit to all those we can, whatever their situation, let's set a motivation today for listening to the Dharma so that we can purify our minds of all aggressive negative thoughts and bring some real peace to the world. Of course, the Buddha is the best in calming people's mind and helping them to see what brings happiness and what brings suffering. So we should really set our motivation to become a Buddha, to be of the greatest benefit to all beings. We can have no greater motivation than that. So let's see if we can make that our motivation. Thank you. Now, in previous weeks, we've been progressing through the 6th chapter of a text by the great master Shantideva called A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It's the chapter on how to develop patience, the antidote to anger. In our previous discussion on David Hicks, for example, this chapter tells us how to react with compassion and wisdom rather than with the intention to harm. I'm also using as a reference His Holiness the Dalai Lama's book, Healing Anger, which is a commentary on this chapter. In previous programs in this series, We've seen how the fuel for anger is the discontented mind that grinds on and on, building on its own unhappiness until it eventually explodes in a burst of anger. Therefore, says Shantideva, we're best not to let anything damage our cheerfulness of mind. After all, if something is wrong, but it can be fixed, there's no need to worry about it. We just have to fix it. But if it cannot be fixed, again, we should not worry about it. We just have to accept it and let it pass in due course. We also saw how Shantideva points out that in this type of existence, the causes for unhappiness are many, but the causes for happiness are comparatively very few. So how can we expect things to go well for us all the time? It'll be much better for us to realize we can never find anything but problems and difficulties in this life, and so develop some renunciation. Instead of getting angry when we encounter some harm or dissatisfying situation, it's better, he says, if it makes us more determined to escape cyclic existence, this continual round of birth and death, birth and death. Shantideva goes on to say that everything becomes easier as we become more and more familiar with it. So the more we get used to the mind of patience in the face of difficulties, the easier it will be to deal with those difficulties. And over time, such difficulties will bother us less and less. After all, we already put up with minor irritations like the bites of insects, hunger and thirst, and so on. So it's not as though we're trying to practice something completely strange and novel. It's just a matter of using that experience whenever something difficult arises and refusing to let the mind get all upset, angry, and miserable. Also, all our problems don't come from the outside as much as from the way our mind is set. If we shiver every time we think of something bad happening to us, obviously we will be upset with the slightest negativity. Whereas if our minds are firm and resolute, even harsh problems will not seem too difficult for us to deal with. So Shantideva concludes verse 18 of the text with the words, "And so I'll scorn all injury, and hardships I'll disregard." That is where we got to in the last program. The next couple of verses indicate the benefits of putting effort into conquering the afflictive emotions. As you know, most of the time we just let our mind do whatever it wants to do, more or less without any attempt to control it. Because of this, the mind controls the person, and we constantly create the causes to take rebirth again and again. But what will happen if we do start taking control of our lives and not letting the uncontrolled mind run away with us? In verse 19, Shantideva says, "When sorrows fall upon the wise, their minds remain serene and undisturbed. For in their war against defiled emotion, many are the hardships, as in every battle." Here, by the wise, Shantideva is referring to those who have trained their minds not to be stirred up by suffering. And the word undisturbed indicates that their minds remain happy no matter what happens. Shantideva understands that the cultivation of tolerance and patience is actually a battle against their opposites, hatred and anger. So he talks about it as if it were a war. And of course, when we conduct a war, we have to expect our enemy will cause many problems and difficulties. If we cannot undergo such hardships with a calm and peaceful mind, it's unlikely we'll be able to win the war against our enemy's hatred and anger. So the text goes on to say, "Thinking scorn of every pain and vanquishing such foes as hatred, these are the exploits of a conquering hero. The rest is slaying what is dead already." Okay, so what is a true hero? Let's take a rather extreme example. In his heyday, Mike Tyson was a hero to many. He was a strong fighter and boxer who beat just about everyone he got into the ring with, and anybody that wanted to take him on outside the ring as well. However, Mike Tyson's enemies were all on the outside, people who crossed him in one way or another. He never saw the enemy on the inside, And so, although for a short time he was able to declare he was the best in the boxing world, he was still under the control of anger and belligerence. He was actually not a champion. He was a slave. No matter what man or beast he conquered, as long as he let his anger loose, he would never be a free man. He would never be a real hero. He would only cause more and more destruction to himself and to others. In contrast, take Nelson Mandela. Here is a man who suffered the most awful indignities and spent time in prison for 20-odd years. Yet when he came out and became the most powerful man in South Africa, he refused to seek revenge, but instead created the conditions for forgiveness and harmony. So who is the real hero? Even in a worldly sense, Mandela is the real hero. He conquered any hatred he may have felt for his oppressors and concentrated his life on the benefit of everyone in his country. Whereas once Mike Tyson had lost his crown in the sporting world, the only news he ever made was for harming himself or others. If instead of letting his anger rule him, Tyson had learned to take control of his negative emotions and reacted with much more love and compassion, he would have had far fewer detractors and enemies than he now has, and his mind would be much more peaceful. This is what this verse from Shantideva is saying. A real hero is one who refuses to take defeat as an option in the fight against the negative emotions, and particularly anger motivated by hatred. No matter what hardship they have to go through, a real hero will not allow hatred to motivate any of his actions. I'm reminded again of a story His Holiness the Dalai Lama often tells in his teachings. It came out again in an interview he gave not so long ago. The interviewer said to him, "More than 40 years ago, you were forced to flee your homeland. Since then, Tibet's culture has been suppressed and many Tibetans have died from persecution. You must feel anger or hatred about this." His Holiness answered, "Anger, I think sometimes. But hatred, almost none. We're trained not to." And then His Holiness tells the story. "I recently met an old monk from Tibet who spent almost 20 years in the Chinese gulag. While he was explaining his suffering, he mentioned that he was faced with a difficult situation on a few occasions. I thought of some danger to his life, but he explained that he faced the danger of losing his compassion for the Chinese. He knew that he suffered because of his past lives, his past karma. And now these persons who create this suffering, they're creating new karma and they have to face long-term negative consequences as a result. So this is reason to feel concerned for them." And then His Holiness goes on, "But reducing anger does not mean we give in. We carry on our struggle for our rights, for justice, but without anger. I think the real meaning of nonviolence, the demarcation between nonviolence and violence, is not action alone, but mainly motivation." What His Holiness doesn't mention here, but which he has talked about on other occasions about the old monk, is that he seemed to suffer no ill effects from his experiences. If, for example, I had gone through the same suffering, I would probably have had many psychological after effects, like post-traumatic stress and so on. But His Holiness has commented on other occasions that the Tibetans he encounters seldom seem to have such reactions to their experiences. And that may well be the result of not giving in to hatred, aversion, and depression, but accepting that one has caused the karma to have these experiences oneself. If we want liberation and enlightenment, we have to control and overcome our negative emotions. That is the whole meaning of gaining liberation. Liberation is freeing ourselves from suffering and its causes, the afflictive emotions like anger and so on. Of course, as we have said, this is no easy task. But if you think about the alternative, it is easy to see that it's a task that has to be accomplished. Imagine living for thousands of eons in the same or a worse situation that you're in now. Would you be able to bear it? That is the alternative. Countless coming lives of the same or worse. Whereas, if we can free ourselves from the afflictive emotions, we will never have to suffer, never mind create outside enemies, ever again. And that is our choice. That is why the person who takes on and defeats the afflictive emotions is the real hero. Such a person will never cause him or herself or anybody else any harm or suffering ever again. As His Holiness says, by defeating the internal enemies, we defeat all the external enemies as well. In the last line of the previous verse, "The rest is what is slain already," the text points out that the external enemy has to die at one time or another. It's only a matter of time. So actually, killing an external enemy is merely destroying something that is already on the way to the slaughterhouse. And there's nothing very heroic about that. Somebody who does that will not have stopped their own suffering. In fact, through the negative karma they've created, they will have created causes for even more suffering in the future. At this point, His Holiness points out that if we pay attention, we can easily see the negative effects of the afflictive emotions. They automatically afflict one's mind and cause a disturbance in one's psyche. We can easily recognize how they destroy our peace of mind. What is more difficult to see is that if we apply their antidotes, they can be overcome. Is it true that liberation from the afflictive emotions actually exists? Some Western psychologists believe that they're just part of our makeup and serve a useful function, and we should accept them as such. Why then do the Buddhists say that they can be overcome and must be overcome? Well, first of all, His Holiness points out that these delusions are distorted in their mode of apprehension. They come about because of our incorrect and illogical way of looking at reality. The text goes into this in some length in coming verses. But briefly, the reality we see and grasp at is not the reality that truly exists. Take, for example, someone you have some real aversion towards. In the past, this person has done something to annoy or irritate you. It could have been something quite small and insignificant. However, it dwells in your mind, and when you see that person doing something else, the mind immediately puts a negative cast onto whatever it is that person is doing. They might be doing something quite innocent and without harmful motivation, but your mind projects some harmful motivation onto that person's action. From there on, the process spirals. Each time you see that person, aversion arises and grows in your mind until you can't stand even seeing that person or even hearing their name. You see, the afflictive emotions exaggerate the positive or negative qualities of an object and then react not to the object, but to the picture of exaggerated qualities in their mind. And this is true for both aversion and attachment, which you can see if you look at how people react when they're in love. Sometimes they appear to be completely insane. His Holiness says that in contrast, the antidotes are not based on such distortions. The pure wish for someone to be free from suffering, which is compassion, or the pure wish for them to have happiness, which is love, wants nothing for oneself, so there's no need to distort anything. Whereas the distorted mind is very much focused on what it can gain, the happiness it thinks the object it is focused on can give it. Anger motivated by hatred is very much concerned with protecting the self, putting oneself in a winning position and destroying in one way or the other the object of one's anger. Patience, the antidote to anger, on the other hand, is more concerned with not creating harm for the object or the whole situation. It is a more peaceful, selfless, and happy mind. as His Holiness in His personal life consistently demonstrates. Secondly, through training and familiarity, the antidotes can be strengthened, and if that is true, necessarily the afflictive emotions and deluded thoughts will be weakened. If we continually develop a peaceful and patient response to the difficult situations we meet, we will strengthen those qualities within us. And then, because we have strongly focused on patience, it will become increasingly more difficult for anger and impatience to arise. The less use those negative emotions get, the weaker they become. Then thirdly, according to Buddhism, the essential nature of the mind is pure, clear light, or Buddha nature. When we experience the true nature of the mind, it is a non-material phenomena, clear and knowing. In itself, it is devoid of the afflictive emotions, like the sky is not the same as the clouds that pass through it. When the clouds have dissipated, the sky is left clear and radiant. From a Buddhist perspective, that is also true of the mind. The afflictive emotions are just adventitious events like the clouds in the sky. They are not an intrinsic part of the mind itself. We can get an idea of this by sitting in meditation, letting the mind settle, and remembering a previous occasion we had an argument with someone else. The emotion arises. But then if you stop the remembering and focus solely on the emotion itself, what does it do? It naturally fades until the mind is left clear again. In a rough sort of way, this shows that anger and so on are not an intrinsic part of the mind. Otherwise, they would always be there, which they are not. Now, because of these reasons, it's possible to eliminate the negative states of mind and liberate oneself. His Holiness says that if we pay enough attention to our mind and experiences, these points will become clear, even though it may take a lot of analysis and inference. We don't need to believe in any scriptural authority to understand them. Of course, the Buddha taught many things, some of which may cause doubt to arise in the mind, like karma, for instance. Is there really such a thing as a karma working out our destiny? We can't see karma, and sometimes it's very difficult to see how an event is the result of something that we did in a past life. However, if we look at the Buddha's teachings, he describes so well the causes and conditions that we actually see that rule our lives, we can have confidence in those teachings he gave about phenomena that are really hidden from our senses, like the working of karma. Especially so, as past masters have, through intense and prolonged practice, found it to be so, and taught what the Buddha said was correct. The next verse in the text, verse 21, goes like this. Suffering also has its worth. Through sorrow, pride is driven out, and compassion felt for those who wander in samsara. Evil is avoided, goodness seems delightful. This verse describes the benefits of meditating on suffering. First of all, if we can see that we will inevitably have to die as well as be separated from good health, our possessions and close ones, and if we can see that although we may have a good rebirth this time around, we have no guarantee it will be good next time, our arrogance is dispelled. Well, what is your situation now? You may have a nice house, a couple of cars, and plenty of money in the bank. You may have lots of good friends who tell you what a good person you are and bring you many gifts and so on. Now imagine that tomorrow you suddenly feel very sick, and when you go to the doctor, he tells you that you've caught leprosy and that your toes, fingers, nose, ears and so on are all going to rot and fall away. How would you feel? Can you see that any pride you had in your possessions, friends and fame immediately disappears? You can hardly be arrogant with no nose now, can you? People would just laugh at you. So that's one good thing about encountering suffering. It really puts us in a position where we can no longer think we are better than others. But it goes further than that. If I have leprosy, I have to take notice of others in the same situation. And realizing my own suffering, I realize that they are suffering just as much as I am. So I'll be very hard-hearted if I don't develop some compassion for them, some brotherly feeling for them. Then we can extend that feeling even to those who do not have leprosy, because they're all going through some form of suffering or the other. Very few beings on this earth are completely free from suffering, and through our discomfort, we can identify with them and so develop a very wide-ranging compassion. And then if we contemplate the causes of suffering, we can get yet another benefit from it. What are the causes of suffering from a Buddhist perspective? Karma and afflictive emotion, of course. So as much as we don't want suffering, so much we have to stop its causes if we don't want to encounter it again in the future. The substantial cause for me getting leprosy is not coming into contact with some infectious person. That is just the condition. The actual cause is some karmic action I created in the past, which placed an imprint on my mind. That imprint ripened into an unhappy experience when it met the right conditions. If I don't want to meet this and all kinds of various sufferings again in the future, I have to prevent the causes from them happening by not creating any more negative actions. I'll have to follow a virtuous life and avoid negativities. So here again, my suffering has the benefit of reminding me to stop behaving badly and to develop a delight in creating positive deeds. So this is what verse 21 meant. His Holiness cautions us, though, that we have to keep a meditation on suffering within its own context. It's no good if we're thinking about suffering just to get depressed and miserable. If that happens, we have to think about our positive qualities and our spiritual progress so far to give us heart and courage for the practice. His Holiness compares our practice to a seedling. At first, one has to be gentle with it, not giving it too much moisture and light. Later, when it's vigorous and strong, it can be treated more robustly. His Holiness reminds us that as Buddhists, we should not fall into extremes. Sometimes we need strength in our practice, and other times we must be gentle. In this way, a balanced approach will take us most skillfully to where we want to go. Then in verse 22, Shantideva goes on to explain why it's unsuitable to get angry with sentient beings. I'm not angry with my bile and other humors, fertile source of pain and suffering, so why should I resent my fellow creatures, victims too of like conditions? When inanimate objects cause us difficulties, we tend not to get angry with them. Shantideva uses an example of getting sick through an imbalance in the body. Of course, in his day, illness was not explained in terms of viruses and bacteria, but rather as an imbalance of the humors, much in the same way as our Western ancestors explained them in the Middle Ages. Shantideva says that when we get sick from such an imbalance, we don't get angry with the humors, so why should we get angry with people who are actually controlled by the same conditions as the humors? In other words, people who harm us are driven by their karma and conditions. They are not independent and in control as we think they are. As the humors get out of balance through conditions, so too people who harm us do not do so because they particularly want to harm us, but because they are controlled by factors other than themselves. This being the case, why do we not become angry at our humors, but become angry with other people? Now that's a question I'm going to leave you with this week, and we'll talk more about it next week, as I've run out of time. Before we go, please take a moment to dedicate the positive energy we've accumulated from this program to gaining enlightenment, so we will be of greatest benefit to all other suffering sentient beings. Thank you. And thanks for joining me today. I hope you'll do so again next week. Until then, goodbye.